yesterday watching Professor David Banks, because a lot of what I'm going to say is sort of coming at the same questions, but from a more historical angle. So I'll open proceedings today by bringing up something a lot of you may recognise, I hope at least one of you will, which is the Caffrey Loop of Wargaming. There we go. And it's based on the fact that just as all hypotheses need to be checked, the history of wargaming should inform how we think about the theory and the practice of wargaming. My contention today, though, is that the foundation of this pyramid is perilously weak at present. And while the discipline of wargaming has advanced in great leaps over the past decade, there's been innovative research on the underlying theories of wargaming, innovative new techniques, such as, experimental wargaming, for example. The study of its past has really not advanced to the same extent. So I'm going to argue that we need a more rigorously, deeply researched history of wargaming, which looks more broadly than just how wargames have been conducted in the past, but which also take into account the underlying context, which I argue is urgently required to understand them. Although there have been individual case studies, descriptions, and accounts of historical wargames, no single work has focused exclusively on the historical dimension. And in wargaming scholarship, historical games have principally been used to give examples of where wargaming has succeeded, sometimes erroneously, and often robbed of the surrounding context. These examples also trend towards the uncomplicated success stories. For example, see how long you can last mentioning you work in wargaming to a British naval officer before they mention the Western Approach's tactical unit. Today I'm going to use our understanding of wargames played in a decade before the First World War as examples of where we need to rethink and improve on our understanding of these games. I've chosen this period because it is a really rich period in which we have some very, very good examples of wargaming from all countries across Europe. It's also relatively well known historically, and most of the historical events I reference should be well known. Lastly, there is a frequent mantra in some corners of the wargaming community that armies who wargame win. I think today I'm going to suggest a wordier amendment, and I'm grateful if anyone's got anything pithier than this, which is armies which publicise their wargames after successful campaigns advertise wargaming well. I'm going to start with rigour, talking about rigour. And I think this is one of the most pernicious elements of a study of historical wargaming, emphasis on the history, which is a lack of historical rigour. It's distinct from what many defence analysts in the room may define as rigour, so I'm going to quickly define historical rigour, which is the systematic and transparent application of critical methods to historical sources and their collection, ensuring credibility, coherence, and trustworthiness through ethical integrity and methodological consistency across a whole study. Whereas in defence analysts, rigour is more reflects a structured quality assurance framework for policy analysis rather than interpretive scholarship. So please divorce your mind from the defence analyst version of rigour for the next 10 minutes. Poor historical rigour when assessing historical games often means that wargaming scholars become stuck in feedback loops of secondary literature, which heavily dilute the original primary sources which originally reported on each game. There's also little exploration of the broader historical literature around this, which inevitably stamps out a lot of the nuance that we get from our understanding of these games. So let's look at, for example, a wargame run by the British General Staff in 1905, about a German invasion of France via Belgium, which you might think sounds quite a familiar historical scenario. One book reports that this wargame indicated the Germans would destroy the French army before the British Expeditionary Force could intervene in strength. In fact, the wargame reported that after several days of fighting, the German advance would have received such a severe check and their trains would have been thrown into such confusion that supply service would have been so disorganized and their troops would become so mixed up that several days must have elapsed before they could operate offensively in a westerly direction. On the other hand, Some have noted that this game was an unqualified success, and the MOD Wargaming Handbook notes that as the war game progressed, it allowed Grierson, who organised the game, to presciently anticipate the Schlieffen Plan and the British commitment to Belgium in 1914. I'll return to this later, but in fact, the German invasion of Belgium was not a result of play during the game. It wasn't as a result of decisions, but it was actually baked into the war game scenario, which introduced it, which emphasised the fact that Germany was only invading after several months of war and in limited strength. So in fact, the war game scenario concluded that Germany can gain no prospective military success by making her main effort through Belgium. So much as with our own war games, we need to be extremely wary of looking at historical designs and pre-baking the conclusions into these historical war games. Primary sources have also been used infrequently, and there's only one book on wargaming, which I found, which is Wilson's, which references this 1905 game, the original report, I should emphasise. But even this has methodological issues, and Wilson asserts, rather than evidences, that the war game was significant in changing minds about the requirements for mobilisation and scheduling. In fact, the eventual programme which would lead to the BEF mobilising so rapidly in 1914 wasn't actually drawn up until 1910, which was 5 years after the game, and only when Grierson was replaced as DMO, which was Director of Military Operations. This brings me on to an interconnected element with historical rigour, and we cannot understand war games solely through reading contemporary war game reports. There is a desperate need to understand the broader context alongside consulting these original documents. So first we need to understand the role and function of wargaming within armies' planning processes. As wargamers, we can often simplify these processes. For example, I'll read out some sections from the historiography or wargaming scholarship about a Russian war game which was played in April 1914 about an invasion of East Prussia, an invasion which most of you will hopefully know was in fact carried out only 4 months later. Wilson reported that the game of April produced an important lesson. The Russian First Army, which had been allotted the more northerly of the two invasion routes into East Prussia, arrived on the battlefield 6 days ahead of the Second Army, whose route was more difficult. As a result, the two armies became separated, and the game showed that they would thus be soundly defeated. Another scholar, I think it's Mason, reports only that Russians identified the risk of the Mazurian Lakes through their war games, which I'd argue is something they could and did quite easily identify just by looking at a map, and by implication, did nothing about these risks. Again, I think this is... truth is much more complex. So it's interesting. These games are often interesting, but I think they ignore the several elements of context which actually negated against much possibility of changing entire logistic organisations and mobilisation orders, which are far wider than just war games. The actual war game itself noted the need to build up a stronger logistics base, for example, rather than just to change the orders, and to fully mobilise both Russian armies before advancing. This was quite difficult to achieve because of both the strategic context that the French wanted a quick invasion of East Prussia, and also the absence of rail infrastructure, which would have taken years to build, to support this earlier Russian mobilisation. Wilson concludes only that both armies needed to change their orders so they would march over the frontier at the same time rather than 6 days apart. So both logistic and strategic contexts made the instant implementation of these wargame conclusions suddenly much more difficult, especially in only 4 months. This problem of context, I think, is also worsened by a slightly promotional approach to wargaming history, which often centres wargaming within the narrative, when actually it's a fairly incidental element of planning. So let's return to the MOD Wargaming Handbook and what it says on the 1905 British war game, and it reports that the war game's outcome led to a host of actions which ranged from reworking mobilisation and cross-channel plans to joint Anglo-Belgian planning and the Entente Cordiale with France. The war game significantly influenced British military strategy in the years to come and is an excellent example, possibly the first, of a war game affecting the course of British history. I'd like to contrast this with what some historians, such as Bill Philpott, say about the game, who writes that in attempting to examine strategic assumptions critically for the first time, the war game began the process of replacing nebulous ideas with practicable military options. From this study emerged the paradoxes which were to preoccupy the staff in their future planning. Firstly, the idea that British military intervention might be more effective if a British army was sent directly to support the French army rather than deployed in Belgium. Secondly, the small size and slow mobilization of any British army was identified. Could a British army arrive in time and in sufficient strength to make an impact on the outcome of the campaign? So I think Philpott's analysis makes it clear that although Grierson's war game had value, it was still a smaller part of a wider planning and of policy processes. So war games are significant. I'm not arguing against that. But I think by framing them as vital, central to decision making, I think we're just as guilty of encouraging misapprehension of what they can achieve as those who've denigrated the technique in the past. My last point is about the bias introduced by our very incomplete access to historical sources. Most war games that we know about because they were significant and they've been immortalized in histories or mentioned in participants' memoirs. This is worsened by wargaming scholars' heavy reliance on secondary sources and therefore feedback loops, which tend to cover the same games over and over again. As we discussed earlier, sometimes these secondary sources haven't even read the original reports, or they've put together doubtful chains of logic based on these reports. So I want all of the wargamers here to think about how many wargames they've delivered over the years. Then I want you to think about how many of these were published and covered nationally, let alone are going to be remembered in 100 years' time. And I'd be surprised if it weren't a very, very tiny percentage. And the same is true about history. The sources for these games are buried deep in archives, which are often not configured to easily uncover records of war games. The British, for example, ran regular war games at Staff College Camberley throughout the period. The French Army ran war games both as part of annual manoeuvres and to rationalise their doctrine. As we've mentioned, the Russian Army took enthusiastically to wargaming. And of course, we also have the German Kriegsspiels alongside their own annual exercises. These have been covered as much as able by modern historical scholarship, and I draw attention to John Curry's efforts at wargaming archaeology especially. But there are an enormous amount of games which are unexplored in archives and which really can only be discovered through intensive, focused inquiry into specific topics. So part of developing our understanding of the history of wargaming needs to be digging really deep into the archive, understanding how armies used wargaming with context and historical rigour, and how this fit within wider military culture and activity. So I've made the case today, then, for the requirement of a much deeper understanding of the history of wargaming. I think, as my fellow panellists are about to demonstrate, this has already been done, but there certainly needs to be much more done. Lastly, the history of wargaming is important to understanding their value and contribution, as Professor Banks demonstrated yesterday. But unfortunately, at present, there's both a lack of rigour and of context in a lot of the existing study of it. So what this calls for is a far greater depth of research and far broader analysis of these games. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for that. So, I was at the